Hello, I'm Ross Camidge, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And my guest this week is literally a legend, somebody who has totally changed clinical trials, and I don't just mean in cancer. My guest this week is Tom Fleming. Tom, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Great, Ross. Well, it's surely a privilege here for me to be with you. An important goal in my life has always been to make a difference for others and to do so hand in hand with others who've had, in turn, an amazing impact on my life. I'm a husband. I'm blessed to have my best friend as my wife, and I'm a dad. I have four talented and caring children, and now I'm a grandpa with 10 amazing grandkids. And after spending 7 postgraduate years on the faculty at the Mayo Comprehensive Cancer Center, for the past 42 years, I've been professor of biostatistics here at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and UW. I've been a teacher, a researcher in design, conduct, and analysis of clinical trials. And then I've been a collaborator with NIH, both in cancer and in HIV/AIDS research. I've worked a lot with WHO, National Academy of Medicine, industry, and especially with my heroes at FDA.
All right, cool. So I think we're going to frame you as a biostatistician with many, many areas of interest. But let's go back in time. So where was Tom born and brought up?
Thank you. Yes. Well, going way back, I was born in the Twin Cities in Minnesota and raised mostly there. My father was a fairly brilliant person. He had a full ride scholarship to go to Xavier University. And yet he grew up during the Great Depression. And his mother said, "We need to skip college. You need to get in the workforce." And so he became a flight navigator for World War II and then a career flight dispatcher in management for Northwest Airlines in the Twin Cities, which is eventually why I ended up growing up there. My mom was always strongly committed to family values and dedicated her life to raising 7 children and 19 grandkids. And so I grew up with 6 siblings, and all of them, fortunately, are still carrying on their impressive lives, many in that Minnesota area and many in areas of medicine and education. And so growing up there, I was fortunate to have a very supportive family throughout the time I was growing up in a Catholic community. And I wanted to make a positive difference and in others' lives. And my early plan to do so was to do so by pursuing the priesthood, which in fact I started to do back in my early high school years.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big family. I think you told me your mom and dad also came from big families.
Yes, my mom especially in Minnesota grew up with 9 kids. She was number 8. My dad grew up she grew up in Minneapolis. My father grew up in Portsmouth, Ohio. And he was one of 4, second in line, the oldest of 3 boys. So yeah, they both had kind of come from traditions of big families and had a big family themselves.
And I think you told me you were the oldest son of the 7 of you. Was it 7 in total?
Right. I had 2 older sisters, and then I was 3rd. And then I had 3 younger brothers and a younger sister. So I had 3 brothers and 3 sisters, but yeah, I was the oldest of the boys. So growing up in Minnesota, I always said the snow is beautiful if it just didn't fall in my driveway, because as the oldest son, I had the privilege of shoveling the snow all the time.
I think you told me you shoveled snow from like October to April or something.
That's right. So I really liked the snow, but yes, it fell in my driveway. And when I shoveled it in November, it was still there in April.
Yep. Wow. So tell me, okay, so this exposes my ignorance. You know, how old are you when you go, yes, I want to enter the priesthood, and why? Or is it kind of like, I mean, there's an old joke, isn't it, that you have a big Catholic family and which one of you is going to be the priest?
Well, and I suppose being the oldest boy, that was maybe partly the reason that was. I was the only one of the 7 kids that had that mindset, even only one of the 4 boys. So it may have been related to being the oldest, but yeah, I kind of think back as long as I can remember back into grade school, it just seemed like if you want to make a difference, it's really a great way to be out there and do something for a lot of people. So it was my view of what I would do from the time I can remember. And back in those days, probably too early, but we started that study when I was 13, just as I was starting a freshman high school. So I was on what would have been a 12-year pathway. I got halfway through those 12 years.
So, yeah. So talk us through what priesthood training is. I mean, it starts super early. And like you say, it's multiple years commitment.
So at least when I started back in those years, it was high school. Well, actually what it was 6 years in what they called Nazareth Hall. It was 6 years of high school and the first 2 years of college. And then it was 6 years in the St. Paul Seminary. It got changed, much to my good fortune, to a 4-4-4 plan, where first 4 years were in high school and then 4 years at St. Thomas College, where I went, and that's where I met my wife, and then 4 years at the St. Paul Seminary. Just as an aside, when I started at 13 years old, I was in South Minneapolis, so I got myself over to Annunciation School, which unfortunately has been very much in the news with the shooting recently, but I went to Annunciation School every morning at 6 a.m. to get picked up to be driven across town to go to my high school. And then I get dropped back across town back at Annunciation School and then hitchhiked my way home and did that for 2 years. And unfortunately, this sad news in the news recently surely brought back a lot of the memories, because that Annunciation School looked exactly like it did when I was there back 60 years ago.
Yeah. And then, okay, so you, when you move from sort of high school and then you, is the kind of university equivalent, the seminary bit, or is the seminary the whole thing?
It's all 12 years. It was all 12 years in that period. But what I think they learned is that starting people too young. And I went through 6 years of that. There were 78 of us that started. When I left after 6 years, there were only six left. So I outlasted 72. So it was all considered the seminary, all 12 years.
Okay, so tell us how you met your wife.
Fortunately, they changed the 6-6 program to 4-4-4 when I was there. So I then started college at St. Thomas College in St. Paul. And hence I was in what was the fifth year of that seminary studies. And down the road from St. Thomas is St. Kate's College, which is where my wife went. And we were both into physics. And so we met in freshman physics. She was amazing. She always finished her labs ahead of me. And I'll never forget this date. It was on October 3rd, 1968. So it was in my freshman year at St. Thomas. I met her, we formally met, and we were sitting at a bulletin board for the classroom where the physics exam scores were posted. And regarding a really key question on the board, we both agreed the professor was wrong and both of us were right. We had a same answer. And that was formally when I met her. And she's remained my companion and best friend for the 57 years since then.
Well, I think you told me a story of, you know, young, desperately shy Fleming sort of seeing girls for the first time as they walk into the physics class.
You bet. Yep. That is true.
So I remember what you said. Yeah.
Yep. The first day in that physics class, I remember watching six women come walking in on the bus from St. Kate's. And I just remember saying, gosh, I wonder what it'd be like to marry one of those as I'm in the seminar. But then when we were in physics lab, she was sitting in front of me and she always finished ahead of me, and I was too shy. I wanted to introduce myself to her. So I waited for her to put her lab book over on the side and leave. And then I picked it up and I couldn't pronounce her name. So I didn't, but then I ran into her, as I mentioned, at that bulletin board, and that's how we met.
And then you also have a very nice story as to how somehow, so your wife's first name is Jolie, is that right?
Jolie, correct. Exactly, yeah. Right.
And so you starting to become interested in Jolie seemed to be incompatible with the path of a celibate priest.
Yes, right. And so at that point, it just seemed to me that where I could really best make a difference was to pursue a career where I really did have opportunities to expand on my mathematical backgrounds. And St. Thomas had a fantastic professor. I took him for 7 classes, and I learned a huge amount from him. And also it was clearly at that point, critical if I wanted, as I did, to spend my life with Jolie as a partner. I made a career change at that point.
And so you left the seminary with a bachelor's degree in maths and physics. And then, you know, what were you thinking you were going to do at that point?
Basically, I left the seminary formally, but I fortunately just carried on with my undergraduate training at St. Thomas. And I had that fantastic professor who set me up really well for going on to graduate training. I had talked to the lead at the University of Minnesota in their medical school program and said, hey, would this be an option for me? And this was an astute person saying, it sounds like from what you're describing with your math and physics background, that while you're keenly interested in medicine, it would be best to continue to pursue your strengths, get a graduate training in what eventually would be biostatistics, and then apply that, you know, as the approach to medicine. And so that's what we did. My wife, Jolie, and I went on to graduate school at University of Maryland in the Washington, D.C. area. And Jolie was a teacher, and she was also a student at University of Maryland, and then became a code breaker as a cryptanalytic mathematician for the National Security Agency.
Wow.
During the 5 years we were there from 72 to 77. And at that time that I was pursuing my PhD training at the University of Maryland in math and statistics.
So let me go back a wee bit, because one of the things, you know, maybe Jolie is perfect for you because she speaks the same language, but I often wonder whether people who are really good at math, you know, it's almost like if they're speaking a different language from other people, because it's so esoteric and potentially other people don't kind of get you. Did you ever have that feeling?
Well, it's interesting, Ross. I basically I always felt like addressing challenging quantitative issues was fun. It seemed like fun. And as a young person, I was surprised that wasn't everybody's perspective. You think this is fun too.
Yeah. And then we kind of touched on it. Were you interested in medicine just as a means of applying, you know, your math? Or were you ever interested in actually pursuing medicine itself?
Well, basically, I was clearly following where my strengths were, which were on the quantitative side, but I clearly wanted to apply it in a way to make a difference for healthcare. And that's why at least I had met with the physician who was leading the University of Minnesota program for medical school. But it did become clear, as that person recognized too, that for me, the best approach would be to pursue my PhD in graduate school. I always had planned in graduate school then to not just get a master's, but get a PhD. And then to develop quantitative skills that would allow me then to engage in both teaching and research in the best way possible to make a difference for others. And obviously that very much involved also possibly getting involved in medicine. My ideal was to basically to be able to assist in evidence-based development of evidence-based interventions for treating and preventing diseases. That was very much always my view of what I wanted to do. And hence, when I finished my PhD program, I wanted to teach. And so it seemed like, okay, I want to go to academia. And yet this was now 1977. And I realized if, you know, I really wanted to be involved in a way that even from a quantitative perspective to make a difference in healthcare, I needed to learn a whole lot more than math.
Yeah.
Even as much as that was fundamentally important, I needed to get the training and experience in clinical and medical areas. And so for me, having come from Minnesota, Mayo Clinic seemed like a great place to go. And it really was in my career when there were 2 or 3 decision-making points that I think in retrospect were really key. This was the first one, realizing that even though I wanted to get into teaching at premier universities, but to make a difference in healthcare, I needed to expand my understanding about clinical and medical research. And so I went to Mayo because Mayo to me was the triangle. And Mayo had a triangle. It was committed obviously to clinical care, but there's a huge commitment there to education and to teaching. And so it was ideal for me, not just because I was going back to Minnesota, but it was an ideal place to pursue what I wanted to do. And so I did. And I went to Mayo. And I remember, Ross, they assigned me to the 12th floor of the Mayo building, which was the oncology division. And I said, "You're putting me in the oncology division. I wanted to do cancer research." Well, that tells you how little I knew. I didn't know that oncology was cancer research. So that was my transition to Mayo. It was a great decision to go there.
Yeah. Even now, decades later, you sort of glow when you talk about the Mayo. It was clearly very influential to you. So when you went to the Mayo Clinic, what did you think you were going to do? And then what did you end up doing? Because you were there for a long time.
Great question. So based on the love that I had for teaching, even at that point, and the passion that I had about learning more about clinical research, my sense was, I'm going to get myself in a lot of one-on-one interactions with my clinical colleagues at the Mayo Comprehensive Cancer Center. And that's where I was. And indeed, I think I was right. A lot of effective teaching can be done one-on-one. And a wise thing that I decided to do early on was to not be shy when I talked to my clinical colleagues about how much I didn't know. That if I didn't know things like what's the difference between T cells and B cells, I wouldn't pretend like I did.
Yeah.
Say, "Hey, fantastic. Tell me more about this." But I felt some confidence at the same time that in this one-on-one, I was not only learning a lot from them, I felt like I had a lot that I could offer to them on the quantitative side. So it was a huge learning experience for me for over those 7 years. And something else that has stuck with me throughout my whole life is that I had a statistical mentor at Mayo Clinic. His name was Dr. Bill Taylor. He was a senior statistician. And he offered me a lifelong career challenge. And effectively, his thinking was, "Okay, Tom, you have a background that's quantitative. You have a commitment partly related to your quantitative background of wanting to be objective. But you also have a real commitment of wanting to advance prevention and treatment of diseases." And so he said, that just creates for you not just an opportunity, but when you have an opportunity, you have a responsibility to do what's in the best interest of others. So he offered me what he said was his lifelong career challenge for me, and that was to always strive to be the conscience of the research team.
Wow.
And that's something I've always remembered from him over the years is when I engage in research, whether it's with academic colleagues or industry colleagues government colleagues, my goal is to help do what is in the best interest of advancing healthcare, and to do so in a way as best possible, not altered by the conflicts of interest that occur, which, by the way, is one of the reasons I call FDA my heroes. Industry is invaluable for medical research, invaluable. We can't do it all by government. Thank you, industry. But obviously, there are conflicts of interest there. And so FDA is the conscience of the research team in many ways as well. And I've done as much as I could to assist them for that reason.
You know, it's funny, even as you say this, I remember one of the quotes you gave me from one of the young priests in the seminary about how if you have certain God-given talents, you have them for a reason.
And I think that I learned that, and I got great principles from them, and very much the sense that we all have skills. Obviously, we all have challenges that we have to address, but we all have skills, and that creates this opportunity for us, opportunities, and we have those opportunities. We have a responsibility to use those skills in ways that can best serve others. And that's, for me, it's been a great guide because there's a lot of satisfaction that comes then when you pursue a career where you're doing your best to make a difference for others.
Give me an idea, like in the 70s, when you go to the Mayo, how well established is biostatistics as something required in research?
That's a good question. Obviously, it surely was well established by the time I went to Mayo in 1977. I was fortunate to join my office was in the 12th floor of the Mail Building in the oncology division where I did most of my interactions. I was linked, my home base was in the statistics group at Mayo with many colleagues there who were very impressive. And so it's been, you know, there clearly has been a long recognition that what we do better synergistically by bringing in the quantitative skills with the clinical skills. But I've done my best to try to enhance that.
Yeah, I mean that. I mean, you weren't just a teacher. That's the amazing thing. You were doing your own independent research to change, you know, for want of a better term, the standard of care in statistics.
That's surely part of it. When I went to Mayo, I was surely committed to both advancing the quantitative sciences, but in fact, advancing what we were doing in clinical research. And I had an incredibly great fortune when I went to Mayo to be able to study under Charles Mortel. Charles Mortel was the head of the Mayo Comprehensive Cancer Center. He was a clinician, but wow, Ross, he taught me many, many principles, including what I would consider really good quantitative statistical principles. He had just an incredible vision for what it takes to do quality research. And together, working with Chuck and many others at the Mayo Comprehensive Cancer Center, I think we designed, conducted, and analyzed a lot of cancer clinical trials, and some of them were landmark studies. And we also, we were the first to bring data monitoring committees into oncology studies, where we brought them into the North Center Cancer Treatment Group studies. We formed the North Center Cancer Treatment Group when I got there in 1977, and we brought data monitoring committees in. And working with Chuck and others, we did some important landmark studies. One of the landmark studies I was involved in, and it took the full 7 years I was at Mayo from 1977 to 84, was the first trial that provided statistically significant evidence that we could improve survival in the colon adjuvant setting. And as you know, in the colon adjuvant setting, surgeon goes in and does a complete en bloc resection of the colon cancer, hopefully to try to get clean margins so that there's no local disease. But if that excised tissue has positive nodes, we knew you had a 50% chance of metastatic undetected microscopic residual disease that would lead to recurrence and death within 5 years. And so our study, although there had been many like it before, but were never successful, ours was the first to say you could use effective adjuvant therapy. And that was the combination of 5-FU-levamisole or levamisole alone. And we showed that that provided a 30% reduction in mortality. And I won't go into it, but there were, that time that I had at Mayo was amazing from my perspective and what I learned, and also to participate. Another landmark study that we were involved in was based on some research done by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. Yeah. And what Pauling had shown was that if you give mega doses of vitamin C in pre-terminal cancer patients, you get massive improvements in their survival. And I remember working with Chuck saying, wow, that seems promising, but it doesn't seem plausible that that could be true. And what we then realized was that that study was observational data.
Yeah.
And there was no assurance that those patients that were doing so well were doing so because of mega doses of vitamin C or just because they were selectively better. So we did a randomized trial that we then published in the New England Journal just at the time I finished my Mayo years, showing, well, if you give mega doses of vitamin C, it doesn't do anything. There was no improvement whatsoever in survival. It was all selection factors that Pauling had done. And that was Chuck Mortel. He was an incredibly rigorous clinical scientist. And back in those days, he wanted the Mayo record to be a research dump. He wanted every patient in the Comprehensive Cancer Center to be part of research.
Yeah.
So that we could not only provide quality care for these people, but we could advance science at the same time.
Let me unpick a couple of things there. So the first one I'm going to ask you is, you know, I still see patients in the world of, you know, quackdom getting high dose vitamin C. Does it drive you crazy? It drives me crazy.
Well, the good news is I'm not aware, and our studies didn't show that there were major safety issues. But yes, it frustrates me if what we're doing isn't based on evidence-based research in settings where we have the opportunity to do that. And we did. I mean, we did the Mayo study that says at least if you were in a setting like these preterminal cancer patients, the megadoses of vitamin C weren't providing benefit. It doesn't, I'm not saying vitamin C in other settings couldn't have benefits, but it surely wasn't providing those claimed benefits by Pauling and his colleagues.
All right, let's dig into data safety monitoring committees or DMCs, DSMCs. So they didn't exist. You invented them or they were around and you just sort of promoted them. Give me a little bit of background on that.
So they were actually, the concept was actually created by Greenberg and colleagues at NIH about 10 years before we brought them into the North Central Cancer Treatment Group in 1977. They were created in the mid-60s.
Okay.
But they were implemented only in limited settings within NIH, within a couple divisions within NIH. And that was it. They weren't implemented anywhere else. And we believed very much when I joined with Chuck Mortel and others in 1977 that data monitoring committees provide major benefits, first and foremost, safeguarding the interests of study participants, but also very much protecting the integrity of trials. And one of the ways that you're protecting the integrity of trials is that you're keeping data confidential, which avoids prejudgments that can occur when such data would be widely released.
So, I mean, you and I have sat on those committees. So what we're, again, for somebody who's not familiar with this, you have a randomized study going on. The people conducting the study may not be aware of how the two arms are differing, but a separate committee is able to have, you know, the blinds removed and see how it's going on. And the key thing I've learned from watching you do it is, you know, trying to figure out when there's a real signal there, when it's just a flash in the pan, and when you should pull the plug and when you'd say no, you know, hold the course.
So it's very important for the data monitoring committee when it has such responsibilities to be well informed.
Yeah.
And so that means a number of things. First of all, it means that if I'm going to be on a data monitoring committee, I need Ross with me. Okay. We need to have the diversity of insights that would be quantitative and clinical so that we can be well informed. But we also need to be independent. And if because we have judgment, and I think of a judge, Ross, I want that judge to be knowledgeable and I want them to be unbiased.
Yeah.
So neither of us will be in a conflicted position, will be knowledgeable. And to be knowledgeable, it means that we need to have full access on an ongoing basis to the key safety data, certainly SAEs and grade 3 adverse events by preferred term within system organ class. We also need the efficacy data because I need to understand safety in the context of benefit to risk. So it's really key. I always say, if I'm going to be trusted or trustworthy on a monitoring committee, we need to be properly knowledgeable, because while we are serving science well by having sole access to that emerging data, there are many other entities. They're the IRBs, there's the regulatory authorities, they're the caregivers, the patients, the investigators, the sponsors. They don't know what's happening during the course of the trial. They're trusting us, Ross, to be able to make an informed judgment. But the benefits for doing so is that it has a huge positive in empowering the trial to go on, to be completed. And just to kind of jump to my time now, when I've now left Mayo and gone on to the University of Washington, one of the first things I did when in 1984, when I joined the University of Washington, is I joined the Southwest Oncology Group.
Yeah.
And so we had back in 1977, for the first time, brought data monitoring committees beyond the small division at NIH. We brought them for the first time into oncology trials. But when I went to SWOG, ECOG, SWOG, other groups didn't have data monitoring committees yet. And so one of the first things I did there when I went to University of Washington in the North Central Cancer Treatment Group was to join SWOG, which was a great group to be part of as a cancer cooperative group. And when I did, I approached the head of SWOG, Chuck Coltman, and the head of the Statistical Center, John Crowley. And I said, hey, Chuck and John, we can really enhance the ethics and science of our SWOG oncology trials by having data monitoring committees as well. And the two of them said, yes, you're right. But we do things here by consensus, and we have a steering committee. So Fleming, you're going to have to meet with the steering committee, even though we endorse what you're saying, and convince them that we should have data monitoring committees in the Southwest Oncology Group, Cooperative Group Oncology Trials. So yes, great. I went there, and I'll never forget when I first went there, Ross, there was a very prestigious person there who said, okay, Fleming, I hear you, but you have to give me the scientific justification for why I don't get to see everything now anymore.
Yeah.
Because I've been able to see it. So you have to, and I said, it makes total sense. But I remember him saying to me, what are we going to do at our quarterly or semi-annual meetings now when we meet? Are we going to play tiddlywinks? What are we going to do? You're not going to show us the data. So I said, I hear, you're right. I have to show you why. And so working with Stephanie Green, who was a fellow statistician at Mayo, who also went with me when I went to UW, the two of us basically said, okay, we will look at it from 1977 to 84. Those were my 7 years at Mayo. That's where we had the North Central Cancer Treatment Group. That's where we brought in DMCs. So we didn't show those data to anybody but the DMCs. So we said, we will take 10 major adjuvant trials that we did at Mayo that were in colon cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, and we'll match them up with 10 similar trials at SWOG that were done from 77 to 84, where SWOG didn't have, they released everything. They didn't have data monitoring committees. And so we compared them, and Ross, it was fascinating. If you looked at the accrual rates in the SWOG trials, half of them, they ramped up. Of course, that's typical. They ramped up and they trickled away. They ramped up and they trickled away. Then we looked at the 10 studies that were done in North Central. They ramped up, and this is what we see today, Ross, and they stayed up. That's what we see today because we have data monitoring. It prevented the prejudgment. And so it enabled these trials to be completed in a timely and a reliable way. Furthermore, I used to say, well, back in those days, Fleming, when we showed everything to everybody all the time, that was great for our CPs, Ross, because if we did a four-year trial, we could publish it four times, not just at the end. We also showed that in those settings, there were two or three of those trials where those early publications were really inconsistent with what we saw later on. Yeah. So we took this summary of comparing the North Central Cancer Treatment Group 7 years when I was at Mayo with the same calendar 7 years at SWOG, showed this difference. Steering committee said, we buy it. You've convinced us. And hence SWOG became the next entity in oncology that had data monitoring committees. And two or three years later, Ross, that same person came up to me and he said, you know what? Bringing data monitoring committees in is the best change we have ever made in making our meetings more efficient. We're not sitting here spending all of our time looking at what happened in these first four patients in these trials. We're spending our time looking at reliable results and then planning for what we're going to do in the future.
So this is a beautiful segue into one of your areas of research, which bears your name, the O'Brien-Fleming monitoring boundaries, again, about avoiding prejudice or trying to minimize it. So, you know, we all dream as academics of having something with our name on it, but, you know, you are indeed the Fleming of the O'Brien-Fleming. So who is O'Brien? And tell me about that.
Sure. And that's kind of back to the Mayo days. So Peter O'Brien was at Mayo Clinic, and it was actually my early time at Mayo. When I finished my PhD at University of Maryland in 77, went on to Mayo. About a year later, started working with Peter, who was a fantastic statistician. And we worked together to develop what is this group sequential monitoring boundary, where our goal was, first and foremost, we wanted to protect scientific integrity. So if you look at data repeatedly, there's huge issues of fitting noise and not signal.
Yeah.
So we wanted to be sure that you bet. I want to safeguard patient interest. So if in fact results are reliable, I don't want to carry that study on past that time. But I also wanted to do it in a way to protect the integrity of trials. And so while I would argue, as the Fleming of O'Brien Fleming, do not do group sequential designs in many trials, if those trials are irreversible morbidity and mortality, if it's a death endpoint in cancer, or if it is an HIV infection endpoint, or in cardiovascular disease, if it's MACE, cardiovascular stroke MI, you bet I want to stop that trial ethically early if the results are compelling. But if it's an analgesic, anxiolytic, antipsychotic, I'm with FDA. I want to go to the end. I want to go to the end. I want to get the most robust and reliable results possible. And so this O'Brien Fleming monitoring boundary is intended to be used where it's ethically needed, i.e. where when the results are reliable, even though I would like more robust results, no, I need to report out for the benefit of the participants in the trial and to advance science in the most timely way.
And my simplistic summary of it is, at the beginning, when you don't have much data, you need a bigger signal before you make a decision. And then as you get more data in, the size of the signal that would influence you to stop it early or do something goes down.
You bet. I think with that astute reasoning, we should call it the O'Brien Fleming Kamich design. Yes.
You just made my day.
Right. You have exactly described the concept. Yep.
All right. Tell me about the move to UW, because you are ridiculously advanced. You're like in your early 30s at this point in time.
Right.
So what happens?
Indeed, that's true. Mayo was such a great place that allowed me to learn a whole lot about medicine, but to also advance my career in statistical methodology, that I was able, after 7 years at Mayo, to come out of graduate school and go to what is, in my view, the leading academic institution in the country, in the world, at least one of the top three by any assessment, in training the next generation as a tenured professor. And what actually happened there was my boss, statistical boss at Mayo, Mike O'Fallon, said to me in 1983, "Hey, we want to recruit. We have a spot for another excellent new biostatistician. And we know that Barbara McKnight was recently trained at University of Wisconsin, and maybe we could lure," and she went then to start her career in Seattle with her mentor, John Crowley. And Mike said, give John Crowley a call and see if you think we could recruit. Is Barbara somebody we could recruit? Because we'd love to have her.
Okay.
And John said, "Sure, I will tell her, but she loves," and I didn't know this, her home was also Seattle, so we weren't going to get her. But then John talked to Ross Prentice, who was a person for whom I have also huge respect. And Ross called me back and said, "Well, yeah, I don't think you're going to get Barbara, but hey, we'd like you."
Oh, what?
We have an open spot. We have an open spot. Would you like to come? Surely I wanted to be involved in an outstanding teaching institution, but I'd come to just truly love Mayo.
Yeah.
And we had just built a new home there. So I said to Ross, because you are amazing. And I was involved in survival analysis as well as clinical trials. And survival analysis is just a mecca also in Seattle. I said, "Okay, Ross, I'll come out and see you guys. But Ross, be aware that I'm not leaving Mayo, but I'll come to see you."
Yeah.
And I brought my wife, Jolie, because I would never make a decision like this without her. And we got there. And I remember we got back to the hotel after the second night, and she looked at me and she said, "I don't believe it. Just looking at how you're reacting, I think we're going to Seattle."
Wow.
And she was astute. And the reason is, I already knew that UW was incredible for its medical research, for its alliance and its affiliation with the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, and for its academic research. And yet what I hadn't realized was that the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and the University of Washington, Ross, are just remarkably collegial environments. I mean, it felt like I walked in there, and within 2 days, I felt like I was part of a family. I felt like everybody that was there cared about you and cared about what was in the best interest of students. And it was just a stunning revelation. And I said, "Okay, you know, I'm this is where I want to go." And so basically I did go then to the Hutch and to UW. And for me, it was an incredible opportunity to be involved in teaching and mentoring wonderful graduate students. And I often say, Ross, and it's the truth, when I teach those students, I learn more from them than they do from me.
Yeah.
You know, if Ross, I sit and listen to you teach me something, I learn a lot. But if I have to get up and teach you, you know, I learn things in much more depth. And then when I'm working with gifted graduate students, there's so much that I learn. And so that was a huge part of what I was able to do then at UW, which was to be involved in that teaching and mentoring, but also to continue working in the methods of survival analysis and clinical trials, but to also be involved very much in the design, conduct, and analysis of trials. And so, by the way, just as a really interesting issue, when I did get the chance then in 1984, when I finished the 7 years at Mayo and I began now what's now 42 years at UW, I was part of the Southwest Oncology Group. And what we did, Ross, was we did a confirmatory trial. I remember I mentioned at Mayo Clinic in the 7 years, we did the colon adjuvant trial showing 5-FU levamisole and levamisole improved survival.
Yeah.
So we did the confirmatory trial called, I think, the 0035 cancer intergroup study, which was the same thing, but it was the same thing, but confirmatory. And the results were amazing in that 5-FU levamisole, and it's now a much bigger study, about 3 to 4 times the size, more reliable. 5-FU levamisole did have a 30% reduction in mortality, but levamisole alone had no effect, no effect. And many people said to us, Fleming, why do you support the idea that you spent 7 years from 77 to 84 for the first time showing that we can achieve cures in the colon adjuvant setting, even when you have positive nodes with 5-FU levamisole, and you supported the idea that we were going to do a confirmatory controlled trial for the next 7 years from 84 to 91, confirming that. And I am a strong believer, Ross, in the value of confirmatory trials, as are my FDA colleagues. And this was a classic illustration of why. So first of all, the O'Brien-Fleming boundary was crossed and we had early termination in 89. Whereas the final results would have come in 93. So we got it done 4 years earlier. We submitted to FDA. I had been on ODAC from 1985 to 89. I had just finished my term, which was good because I would have been...
Let's explain what ODAC is.
The Oncology Drugs Advisory Committee for FDA, that is ODAC, that basically makes decisions about whether drugs and biologics should be approved. We brought them the data from this confirmatory trial. Now we had two studies, and FDA, even though we stopped that second study early with O'Brien-Fleming, they recognized that this was now valid data, even though it was early and it was confirmatory, and they approved. They approved. And that was in 1989. So the confirmatory trial, FDA was with us. They believed, as we did, that we needed that confirmatory trial. But that experience, Ross, points out why you need the confirmatory trial. Because if we had only done the first trial, Ross, I often say to my clinical colleagues, what would you use, 5-FU levamisole or levamisole? Well, I would use levamisole. I don't need the extra toxicity of 5-FU. And what we knew in the confirmatory trial is that was the wrong decision. And something that I've often said that it's so proven by this is, it's not so much the things that we don't know that get us in trouble. It's the things we do know that aren't so. And if you take a first trial without confirmation and you act on it as though you know, then you're going to use levamisole. And it's actually, you'd have been better off to realize that you didn't know whether something worked than to think you knew that it did when it didn't. So that was one of my first experiences after having gone to UW, working over that next 5 to 7 years on that confirmatory trial that we had done through SWOG, taking it on to FDA, and it was being done overlapping the time I was serving on ODAC, and then brought to FDA, and it led to a prompt approval of 5-FU levamisole, which is the first approved adjuvant therapy in colon cancer.
So surely not every positive trial needs a confirmatory trial. I mean, presumably, to go back to your O'Brien-Fleming, it depends on the size of the effect, the size of the trial to begin with, or are you literally saying, never believe the first data?
Great question. So I never say never. So it's a great question. In a rare disease setting, there's a trade-off.
Yeah.
In a rare disease setting, I'm not going to get a confirmatory trial. I'm not going to be able to put 1,000 patients on a randomized trial as we did in the confirmatory colon adjuvant study in a timely way. And yet, what I will say is in rare disease settings, what's fascinating is that we know a lot more about the biology. Often we have genetic defects and we come forward with gene replacement, and we're not just looking at 10, 20, 30% reductions. We're looking at 50% reductions.
Yeah.
So you can get much more often than people might think reliable evidence in a rare disease setting. But I get it. I get it. In some of those settings, I would only do a single trial. What is against the a lot of people's intuition, Ross, is that, gee, if pancreas cancer, I have nothing that works. If I get a single trial that works, that's where I should just use a single trial. Wrong. Wrong. That's exactly the wrong logic. If I have an antibiotic for pneumonia, half the antibiotics for pneumonia that I test work. And so I only need a single confirmatory trial, because if I think as a Bayesian, my prior likelihood of an effect before I do the trial is 50%. My posterior is 98% with a single trial. If I have pancreas cancer where nothing's ever worked, where the prior likelihood is 2 to 5%, which is where 5-azulabamisol was,
yeah,
then a single positive trial gets you a posterior 50-50. Ah, that's what happened in the first trial. There were two results. Now I know after the second trial, one was positive, one was negative. That's exactly matching the statistics. But it's against people's intuition. Give me a single trial in pancreas cancer, I'll do two in antibiotics. No, I need two trials. I need a confirmatory trial, or I need a single trial with enormously persuasive results.
Yeah.
So there's not a single easy answer to it, but people's intuition sometimes can lead them astray.
I mean, I can see as a thoracic oncologist that evolution in real time. So when I started and they were doing chemotherapy studies, there was this whole debate as to whether chemotherapy added anything other than toxicity. Now where we're molecularly pre-selecting the patient and giving molecularly targeted therapies where you have a 80% response rate, I don't think we need a confirmatory trial.
Well, and FDA's with you a lot. I mean, if you have a compelling biological argument so that the prior likelihood truly is not like ours was for 5-azulabamisol, then I can live with a single trial if it's truly a really strong, well-conducted, robust result. I still prefer to have confirmatory trials if I could, but yes, we certainly have plenty of precedent for single trials. Part of our problem, though, is I lived through chemotherapy research from my Mayo days on, and I'm so impressed now what we can do in oncology with immunobased therapies.
Yeah.
Where we're no longer just trying to improve PFS by 4 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, we're tripling your survival. Okay, Ross, if we're tripling the survival and we show that, it's not that I needed a p-value of 0.0001, but I'll get one.
Yeah.
One study is enough. But my worry, Ross, is if what we're using in an indolent cancer setting is PFS, because we can't wait for survival, we could be really misled, because that's a whole different issue now. That's using a surrogate endpoint. So yes, Ross, a single persuasive result on Fields function survives in particular, I'm with you. If it's a single trial on a biomarker of like PFS, we are learning. We have classes of agents now that have come back where we've approved these agents on really nice PFS results, and survival's in the wrong direction. Yeah, we have an immune-based therapy through immunosuppression. It has a great anti-tumor effect. Uh-huh. But it also leads to a significant risk of fatal infections. And so I need to understand not just what the effects are through the intended causal pathway, which is tumor shrinkage, but through the global included unintended causal pathways, and the unintended causal pathways are often not captured by the surrogate. But that's a whole nother podcast we could get into.
I know. One of the things that you are, if I may be so direct, famously grumpy about is progression-free survival. And I think it almost goes, again, it goes back to the days of chemotherapy, where this, you know, debate, is there a net good or a net bad given all of the side effects? Are you giving with one hand and taking away with the other? Again, yes. as a molecular biologist, and we get to at least the targeted therapies, the idea that, for example, when the EGFR inhibitors were first developed in EGFR mutant lung cancer, they didn't appear to show an overall survival benefit. And so some countries were, you know, hesitant about approving them. Whereas in the countries, including the USA, which had approved them on the basis of progression-free survival, it was clear that the net population was going up because these people were crossing over in later lines. And the logic that everything good must have something bad I think when you're a biologist, you can sometimes challenge. I'm being a little provocative here.
There's so many complexities. and I believe in PFS or progression-free survival as a really important biomarker measure.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I would never use it for approval. I'm saying I'm more worried about the robustness of that result. And back to two trials versus one, yeah, I'd want to have two trials on PFS, but if you could give me one really robust result on survival, I would take that. And so my worry here is not just how, the false positive error rates and how persuasive this is, but also, is this endpoint measure truly giving us the global reliable conclusions that we need? And so there are many issues that we need to think about when we're designing clinical development. I come back again to FDA. They're incredibly valuable in their role because they are really expert as well in understanding these issues and what's reliable and what isn't reliable. So it is really important that we know a whole lot more now than we knew back in 50 years ago at the beginning of my Mayo days about mechanisms of action. And yet the complexities are still there with these interventions, especially given that an intervention that creates a biological effect that you're intending is readily, plausibly creating other biological effects that you don't intend that are going to also affect VLS function survives in ways that aren't captured by your biomarker.
Yeah. And the other thing to come to your side of the fence is when there's a small difference in progression-free survival between trials, the cross-trial comparison that we're all supposed to not do, I know that I can totally alter the progression-free survival by not scanning someone as frequently or not scanning their brain. If I don't look, I don't get that early progression event. And it's utterly meaningless. It's just the design of the trial.
Yeah, it is. And there are many other, there are so many other issues as well along these lines. I'm a huge fan of CAR T inhibitors.
Yeah.
And what they do when you are looking at them, often you are randomizing to a CAR T yes versus no, but then it might take 3 to 4 months before you can deliver it. And in those indolent settings, people still can die early. And if we're not managing people well, when we know they're being randomized to CAR T, you'll see the survival curves in the wrong direction. But lovely, don't cross patients over, Ross, if you want to know what effects are. And J&J did a marvelous study of their CAR T inhibitor and didn't cross patients over, and therefore were able to show that, yeah, the curves were in the wrong direction early, but then they splayed out beautifully later in time.
Let me be the devil's advocate here. So again, if you put the patient at the center of the equation, then crossover is very attractive because the goal of the patient is not to generate statistical data. The goal of the patient is to live.
I would say the goal of the patient is to be able to do what would be in their best interest, but also patients join trials for altruistic reasons. And if I join a trial and the industry is doing that trial, I'm on it. I've been around clinical trials long enough to know, A, I'm on it because whether I'm on the experimental or the control, I get an enhanced delivery of quality care.
Yeah.
And I can altruistically contribute to science and advance science. But I've also been around clinical trials enough to know, Ross, that what we think we know, we often don't. And so you're not always on the best care when you're on, when you're on the experimental arm. And so it is proper. When you're randomizing, that's equipoise. I believe we do have equipoise. And yes, I surely hope that my experimental therapy will be better. But I've been around clinical trials enough to realize how often those hopes aren't right. And so the right thing to do is to randomize an experimental against a version of established standard of care. And so if your CAR T was already shown to be effective rescue therapy, then yes, I cross in, of course. But if this is first line in a disease indication, I don't cross in because I'm now not, I've taken away the ability of this trial to answer. By crossing in, you're telling me, Ross, I know it works. I just need to know whether I get it now or later.
Yeah.
That's the wrong question. I want to know whether it works. And so I am now engaging participants in a trial in a manner that is, in fact, I would argue, unethical, because the second principle of clinical equipoise is it's unethical to alter the ability of a trial to disturb equipoise, meaning that if you cross in when you didn't know whether or not that intervention was known to be effective, you've just now compromised the ability of your trial to answer the question it was designed to address. So critical point, the control arm in a clinical trial should be a version of standard of care that is established to be a version in the regions in which the trial is done. And so, no, I don't cross in unless I've already shown that this is rescue therapy that's effective in second line. Now I want to see if I should give it in first line instead. Yes, cross in is the right answer there.
Okay. Let's delve into an area that, at least in oncology, people will be less familiar about your contribution. So when you moved to UW, you didn't just study oncology. Somehow you ended up with this additional aspect to your career of infectious diseases. So talk me through how that started.
Great. Yeah, great question, Ross. One of the things I love about statistics is that we can be involved globally. And surely principles in clinical trials apply across the board. Yes, every trial is unique. Every disease setting is unique. But what I've learned in oncology is highly relevant to design and conduct of trials in other areas like infectious disease. And one of the things I always say is, Ross, why is FDA so smart? Ross is smart. I think I'm smart. Why are they so smart? They get to see everything.
Yeah.
There's just a huge amount of insight you pick up when you have breadth of insights. And I'd say the next best thing to having that is to be an academic biostatistician, because I get to at least see globally what's happened, not just in oncology, but infectious disease and et cetera. So when I arrived at UW in 1984 in the Hutchinson Center in 84, I was predominantly an oncology statistician. That's where I began my career. But even at Mayo, I started to delve into other areas, and I was doing a lot in liver transplantation before I left. But I began service on FDA advisory committees right after that. In 1985, FDA contacted me and said, hey, would you like to be involved in advisory committees? I went down the hall to my colleagues, Lloyd Fisher and Dick Cronwall, who'd been on advisory committees, and said, it's the best thing you can do in your life for the amount of time you put in to be able to make a difference and alter science. So I joined the Oncology Drugs Advisory Committee, ODAC, and I continued that service for four decades. I've served as a voting member on 100 occasions on FDA advisory committees, and I do consider it among the most important contributions that I could make as an academic to assist my heroes, FDA, in their regulatory functioning. And then a year later, 1986, second year at UW, I was recruited by Tony Fauci and NIAID colleagues to serve on a data monitoring committee, Ross. And it was a single monitoring committee that monitored every one of the NIAID-sponsored trials for therapeutics for treating HIV/AIDS. And so I served on that committee for 20 years, Ross, and served and monitored 50 trials, wow, over 20 years serving on that committee. And of course, colleagues give me a hard time. I have no worries. But they said, Fleming, when are you going to step up and actually take charge of the research, not just being on monitoring committees? And I said, as soon as you start prevention research. And they did in 1993. They formed, it wasn't just going to be continuing, how do we treat HIV/AIDS? How are we going to prevent it?
Yeah.
And in 1983, they formed at the statistical center here for prevention of HIV/AIDS. And I became the PI of this International Coordinating Center. And I ran it through the Hutch. I was at UW, but I ran it through the Hutch because we had to start up with this massive program. Cancer knew how to do clinical trials. Oncology knew how to do them. Infectious disease didn't. Tony Fauci, though, wanted to keep, you know, this process within NIAID, not an NCI.
So AID is allergies and infectious diseases.
Allergies, infectious disease. You bet. That's where we did HIV/AIDS. And so, yes, so I was funded under NIAID, but I brought in the Hutchinson Cancer Research Center to help me do the infrastructure for all of our international randomized trials and prevention research. And today, if you visit the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, there's an enormous division within Hutchinson's Cancer Center that's the infectious disease division.
Wow.
That's what grew up over the next 32 years over that. And to me, it was a great synergy. Thank you, cancer. Thank you, Fred Hutchins Cancer Research Center. You contributed greatly to our ability to have a proper infrastructure for being able to do design, conduct, and analysis of clinical trials that we then did in HIV/AIDS. And so basically, just to take a couple moments, but I really want to take a couple moments to explain, that led to many, many important contributions. I thought wrongly in 1993 that we would have a vaccine in a couple of years. That vaccine would be the most effective way to prevent transmission of HIV. And by the way, messenger RNAs, thank you so much for COVID. Yeah. We had that within a year. We still don't have one, Ross. But what we do have, and it was the efforts that I was fortunate to be able to be involved in HIV prevention, we have made enormous strides with antiretrovirals to prevent transmission. And just to tell you three real fast stories, what we did in the 1990s for mother-to-child transmission of HIV, what we did 10 years later in roughly 2007 to 2011 for heterosexual transmission of HIV, and what we did in the few years before COVID, which was pre-exposure prophylaxis. So just to say a couple quick thoughts about what we were doing, I was on that data monitoring committee for all of the NIAID trials from 1986 to 2006. One of those trials in 1993 was the first study we ever did to show we could prevent transmission of HIV. It was mother-to-child transmission of HIV. I was on that committee. It was looking at AZT regimen, second and third trimester pregnancy, and then during labor and delivery, and then to the infant. And we prevented like 67% of the transmission.
Incredible.
And by 4 years later, by 1997, we were preventing 80 to 90% of the transmission. But what our group said was, wait a minute, this is now 1997. We had full access now to these regimens, antiretrovirals, to prevent mother-to-child transmission in upper-middle-income countries. In lower-middle-income countries, we had nothing. And that's where most of the women were who were HIV-infected, who were pregnant. And so we went to Uganda. I remember being in Uganda in 1997, and we set up a trial that would be feasible. We don't have access to women in the second and third trimester. In Kampala, Uganda, these moms come down from up country, come walking down into Kampala, Uganda to Omalagwa Hospital for labor and delivery. So we had a regimen called nevirapine, single dose. We're going to give the mom a single dose during labor and delivery, a single dose to her infant. A regimen that, unlike what we had shown in the U.S. settings, would give you 80, 90% transmission that would cost thousands of dollars to mother-infant pairs when the per capita healthcare budget in Uganda at that time was $7. We were able to show that a highly safe, effective, convenient regimen gave 40% reduction in HIV transmission. It was an amazing success. And just for a couple seconds, then a decade later, the biggest method, mode of transformation of infection, Ross, is heterosexual transmission. And Ross, we were not able to, even though if you had HIV infection in US or other upper middle income countries, by 2005, this was no longer a fatal disease. It was a chronic lifelong illness because we could keep you alive for your life with antiretrovirals. They weren't available in Africa and other lower middle income countries where transmission was the greatest. And so we did a randomized trial from 2007 to 11 where we randomized participants in lower middle income countries to starting antiretrovirals when their CD4 count dropped to 250 versus starting it later in time. And what we showed, Ross, was amazing, was that not only did we, in fact, help keep these patients alive who were treated, we prevented transmission to your partner by 95%. 95%. Yeah. And that, for the first time now, motivated the world. Okay, maybe we do have to get antiretrovirals to lower middle income countries because that will prevent the spread to us. Yeah. Whatever, it worked. And I remember it was December 24th, 2011. I got a phone call. I was the senior author on this publication. And every year, Science magazine does a survey of all of science, not just in medicine, but in physics and in aerospace and all. And they decided the scientific breakthrough of the year in all of science was this study that we had published in 2011 showing that we could get 95% transmission. And just one other quick mention, We did another study 10 years later that was basically 2017 to 20 that was looking at, well, treating the person who's uninfected if they're going to be at a high risk, called pre-exposure prophylaxis. And we were comparing to Truvada, which works sort of, but you have to take it orally every day. And when you're healthy, Ross, it's hard to get a person to take something every day.
Yeah.
So we compared it to cabotegravir injections. And against Truvada, which is effective, we got 90% relative reduction again.
Yeah.
And so just amazing progress made between 1993 and 2020, just when COVID hit, where we were able to have an amazing result in mother-child transmission where it mattered, which was in low and middle income countries. And then we were able to 95% reduce transmission heterosexually. And then we were able to say, okay, but that still doesn't get us totally out of it because a lot of people don't know they're infected when they are with HIV. So let's now treat the uninfected person when they're at high risk. And we got 90%. So we never did yet get the vaccine, but we made enormous progress with antiretrovirals.
I love it. So one of the things that you'd said when we were discussing this last time, which I loved, was, you know, the idea of, you know, you do these studies, not just in, you know, the east side of New York, you do them in the third world, you do them when there's no money. And one of the things you said is, if you want to do something important, it's not hard if you're truly committed. Or words to that effect. I mean, you have taken on global challenges, which lesser people would have shied away from.
Well, it is, I mean, it's a good example. I often say, and in fact, I kind of, in kind of final summary of all of what we talk about, I would say, you don't do really important things in most cases without taking on the hard challenges. And I'll just to illustrate that, let me just go back one more time to the Uganda example. When I was in Uganda, as we were planning that trial in 1997 of single dose nevirapine, I said to my colleagues, and you wouldn't be surprised by my saying this, we have to have high levels of retention. Okay, I don't want to have a lot of missing data. There's too much bias.
Yeah.
And so I said to them, when we randomize here, the endpoint is the infant that's born, are they going to become HIV positive? And in that point, the transmission that could occur to these infants was not just during pregnancy and during labor and delivery, but during the 18 months thereafter where they could be breastfeeding. So the primary endpoint of that trial was, by the time the child is 18 months, are they free of HIV infection or not? And I said to my colleagues in Uganda that we needed to have 95% retention of these infants. And they laughed at me and they said, Fleming, you're not at Mayo Clinic anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, you might be able to do that in a Mayo trial. Again, these moms coming from up country, no home addresses, coming on down into Kampala, Uganda, the labor and delivery. And they said, it's just too hard. And I said to them, I agree. It's really hard. But because it's hard, it doesn't mean that missing data is any less harmful to the integrity of research. And what they did, Ross, was amazing. They developed a group of what are called health visitors. And every mother-infant pair had assigned a health visitor who went to visit them at their home sites, subject to the mother being willing to have them come, and provided support to them in ways that wasn't altering mother-child transmission, but was providing good healthcare support to the moms and to the infants. And when we were done, when we finished that trial, they not only had 95% retention, they had something like 98% retention. And so I'll never forget that they laughed at me and said, when I said I wanted 95, that's ridiculous. No, they did 98.
Wow. For someone who's been a full professor for nearly five decades, you don't look like you're slowing down anytime soon. So how are you transitioning, if that's possible, into a quieter life, or are you?
Well, I mean, I would argue here, or what I would indicate is, people say, when are you going to retire? And my argument is, when I'm not needed for the right thing to happen. Which isn't a good definition for retiring soon. But I do care greatly about family. And I certainly am committed to having a lot of time. In fact, I would say having time with family, and surely that's reinforced at this point in my career, is really a high priority. And by the way, it always has been a high priority for me, even not only now as I'm, you know, when would I retire, but during the time that I was younger in my career, I made a commitment that whenever I wasn't involved in professional activities, I was spending that with my family. That would act as an example. I love to teach. I have four kids. For the entire 20 years where they were growing up, I coached every one of their soccer teams, every one of them. I coached 60 indoor and outdoor soccer teams over those 20 years. And because of the nature of soccer, it's a great opportunity to help children of all, not just my kids, all children, not only develop their athletic skills, but basically to teach how much more we can do by collaborating with each other. And it's a great sport for educating those principles. So for me, being with family is an incredibly high priority, and it becomes even a higher priority, I guess, as I'm getting older. And now I have not just the kids and my wife, but grandkids. But for me, it's always been a commitment to be with them whenever I could. And again, to recognize that so much can be learned in those interactions by the coaching of soccer, which are, you know, great principles that I think are important for all of us to realize. And that is what we can all do. We can do so much more effectively by doing it together.
Tom, that sounds like a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us.
Well, thank you, Ross. It's been a great opportunity for me to be able to participate in this impressive podcast with you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.